Today's program was brought to you by Blueprint, the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. For more information, visit blueprint.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's up, everyone? Derek Evers, Chris Robbins, not Christopher.
Never
Christopher. With another post-Thanksgiving, not another, our first post-Thanksgiving episode of Nothing Urgent.
Man, I gained like 38 pounds.
I wish we were actually after Thanksgiving.
you look so different.
Because I would at least have an excuse for this giant gut I've got going on. Have you noticed I've been gaining weight? Have you noticed my unsveltness?
I tend to only say positive things, you know, when
you are, you're my inspiration.
I try and look forward, not downward at your gut.
So this, well, downward at other things. homoeroticism aside, this is the, this is kind of a special edition. This is our holiday edition where
Holiday celebrating what? Thanksgiving's your favorite holiday.
It is my favorite holiday. I love Thanksgiving.
Can we talk about why that is? Because it seems to me to be, you know, a celebration of colonialism.
I guess you could see it that way if you want to look at the origins of the holiday. It would be like, you know, but I like to think of gluttony and laziness as having a war on Thanksgiving and trying to take away Thanksgiving away from the original meaning, which is, you know, pilgrims
gluttony.
Beating Indians.
Okay. Well, I mean, right. So I don't know.
I mean, if the U.S. is trying to steal Christmas from the Christians, then I think it's like the adverse to that, or the good opposite of that is, you know, we're also trying to steal Thanksgiving from the ruthless tyrants of pilgrims that beat Indians.
Okay. So your friend.
Anyway, I like it because I like eating and sleeping, basically.
All right. Okay. I can't. That's fine. I always just feel lazy and sad.
And where's the sadness come from?
Well, red wine mainly.
aren't you supposed to drink white wine with turkey?
No, what?
I don't know. That's a question for the other shows on Heritage. Okay. We have a special episode for you today. I'm actually going to break down the fourth wall here and say that we are pre-recording our post-Thanksgiving episode because we have Andrew Greenberg from Forbes back with us, who is going to be discussing, among other things, the Silk Road, but also Bitcoin Black Friday.
Yeah, I mean, after his story ran a few months ago, the whole story sort of took off. The guy who founded the Silk Road was arrested. He was accused of setting up a bunch of murders that never happened.
Yeah, it was very Breaking Bad-esque. Murders that were supposedly played out, but they were actually fake,
right,
or
it
fraud.
Was a sting.
By the,
yeah. I always feel like, you know, murder for hire never works. Never works the way you want it.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have many?
It never works the way you want it.
Have you had many instances of murder for hire?
Not this year, but, you know, 2014, who knows. Who else do we have on the show today, Dave?
We also have Mish Wei from White Lung and the recently announced Eating Out, which is a, I don't know if I'd call it a side band. We'll have to ask her. I'm having a little problem pronouncing my N's.
All that tryptophan you ate over Thanksgiving.
I know, all the tryptophan. But no, Eating Out is a... It's a super group of sorts from Vancouver, which features her along with members of Peace and New Sensei. And I think she's actually on the phone right now. Joe, do we have her on the phone? I think that's a yes. Mish Wei, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And whereabouts on the road are you right now?
I actually just got home from tour a couple days ago. I'm in my apartment. I'm packing because I'm moving, and it's a nightmare.
And your home is in Vancouver?
Yeah.
We're running a good record here of having Canadians on the band. We tend to. I think we've had more Canadians on the show than we've had Americans. Now you just
because we're better, we're funnier, we're smarter.
You are much more. What's the welcoming, I guess, or like happy to be involved, I would say.
Humble, too. Yeah. So humble, the Canadians.
Especially compared to Brooklynites, you know.
Yes.
So you just got off the road with Antoine.
Yeah.
How was that?
Oh, it was great. I really, it was really fun. We all got along really well. We really like the girls in my band. We really love Antoine's 21-year-old DJ, whose name's Sad Andy. And yeah, we were trying to teach him some things on the road. He's so cute.
So now you're kind of you know, a lot of people recognize the fact that you're also a writer, a music writer, and also in a band. So I guess the question, you know, is the chicken and the egg. What were you making money on first, writing about music or playing music?
I think playing music, because they kind of snowballed at the same time. Like, they both started to kick up momentum, and I was like, oh, I can make money with these two things that I actually like doing. What? Yeah, it was kind of, I think it probably was music, because we were, you know, playing shows.
Right.
But yeah, no, because you know, with writing sucks, you gotta like hustle for free for a long time till anyone gives a shit about you. So
yeah, Chris can attest to that, right, Chris?
I hate writing, and I'm a writer.
Yeah, I actually am hating it right now too. I have like so much stuff I should be working on, and every sentence that comes out, I'm just like, ugh.
When you're on the road, what's your preferred method of working? Like, how do you, or do you write on the road at all, or like, how does that work?
Yeah, I have to. It's, I don't know. I got, like, last Christmas, I bought myself a MacBook Air, like a really small 11-inch one, so I just sit in the back of the van and try and write then, and I'll try and work in the hotel and stuff, but on tour, you know, like, my responsibility levels kind of fly out the window, and so kind of harder to keep up on your deadlines. But then again, there's so much time to just sit there, like, and the van is so boring.
Yeah, you don't get queasy staring at the screen and
no.
Watching it? No, not one of those.
No, I don't really. I don't really get carsick at all. But I don't know. Yeah, I have to do it. Like, it's like, even if I'm away, I still have to make my deadlines. So
someone who interviews bands and is in a band that gets interviewed, what is the question that you refuse to ask? Like, what is the, like, one question you're like, that's just stupid, I'm not going to ask that?
Well, my rule is, like, to treat every interview like a conversation, you know? Like, I'm just talking to this person and trying to learn more about their life. And I'm sorry, but you can frigging Google anything now. So when people are like, ask me a question, like, where did the name White Lung come from? Please. Please, are you serious? You're going to ask me that. You can find that out in 1 second. Less time than it takes for me to answer. But I don't know. I just try and treat interviews with other musicians like a conversation. And yeah.
Yeah, because that's eventually when they'll say stuff. I just usually stick away from the...
shit out.
Exactly. I usually just stick away from the what's your influence question.
Yes. That one's... Or like, what? How would you describe your sound? Like, I don't know. Why don't you just listen to it? Yeah. Like, you go on YouTube. It takes 1 second. You decide. Yeah, I had a guy. I got interviewed by this like French dude the other day, and he asked me if all our periods synced up on tour. And I was like, you know what? Normally, I would jump down your throat and get super mad at you for asking something so dumb, but they do, and. You're already nervous and French, so I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt.
So what's up with the new band?
Okay, I'll tell you the story of Eating Out. It's not a new band. It's actually a very old band. Those songs were recorded probably like 3 years ago at Night Prison, which is this like small studio that our friend Jesse Taylor runs. And we wrote those songs. Those songs first came out on a tape on Burger Records probably 2 years ago. And that was a band that we started for fun. It was like Daniel, Brody, who are both in New Sensei, myself, and Jeff, who plays in Peace. I was playing in another like kind of side project thing with Daniel and this girl, Louise Burns, called Shove, and she just taught me how to play the bass. So I was really jazzed up on playing the bass. And Daniel and I and Brody and Jeff just wanted to start a fun band, and we did, and we wrote a bunch of songs, and those recordings are so old. And so, but now, I don't know, Daniel's got the 7-inch going, and we did a video last year. Daniel made this video. I don't know if you've seen it, for that song, Burn. So, yeah, it's actually a really old band.
Is it something you're going to keep going, or is this kind of just like rehashing some old material?
I'm not sure what's going on with it exactly. As I said, because, you know, like, the song, like, we the last time we all played a show, I think, was we played with Bleach last year, but like we haven't been very active, you know, because like New Sensei was touring, Wai Lung, like we've been touring all year. Jeff was touring with Peace, and Jeff's also a journalist too. He's like an amazing journalist. He does a lot of political writing, but so, you know, it's kind of funny that all that stuff's coming up now and like people are giving it a bit of attention, but it's a project from a long time ago. I'm not even,
yeah. And you guys are all pretty busy anyway, aren't you?
And it was really like when we first, that band was super fun when it first started, because we would all just go down to our jam space that we don't have anymore. Mm-hmm. We have a new space, but, and we used to do like Friday practices, and we would call it 40 Fridays, and we'd just get like a 40 a beer each. And then by the end of the practice, we'd be all so drunk. We'd be like doing, we'd just be like playing Oasis and like screaming and doing like Nirvana covers and like breaking stuff. Like it was just like a crazy, stupid, fun time. And somehow we managed to write like 7 songs and record them. But yeah. Now it's coming out, I guess, on Suicide Squeeze, the 7-inch. Those, they're good songs.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, I mean, Vancouver's known as a pretty creative hotbed. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, yeah. There's lots of good bands from here.
Yeah, it's tough to say being on this coast, as it's like seems so distant and far. But you guys have a ton of bands coming out of there.
Yeah, I think the thing about Vancouver is like it gets labeled as no fun city, which I don't think is true at all. But it's more like the fun is not on the surface. You got to know somebody. It's very like cliquey and cold in that way, kind of like LA.
That's interesting. Stupid. I don't know, Chris. Did you think it was that? I thought it was like kind of like a weed smoking place of Canada, which meant it was kind of cool. But
I always thought of it as
weed.
I always thought of it as being like really clean and pretty, but sterile. But I guess you've just proven me wrong.
It is. It is on the surface. And then it's kind of like, they're trying to redo this city right now. Like they're giving it this giant makeover, you know, like knocking down all these old buildings and putting up lots of condos because it's developing. But as far as music goes here, like there's always been great bands here. And I just think there's a lot more bands that are going out and touring and getting attention and giving Vancouver a name, which is great.
So one of the things I'm a little bit, well, not shy to talk about, but one of the things that like eventually
nervous.
Always, yeah, I guess nervous would be the right word. I'm horrible with words. That's a Chris, my editor.
He's sweating profusely right now.
Then why are you hosting a show if you're horrible with words?
I just know you're people. I know the right people.
Okay.
I shake hands.
I get it.
I scratch backs. But inevitably, the question comes up routinely about women in music, and it's a conversation that we talk about a lot at Impos, because our senior editor is a woman, and she gets like so angry, not angry, I guess that's the wrong word, I don't want to throw her under the bus. She gets really upset about the fact that the conversation even continues, like we just can't talk about it as like they're bands, it has to be like a woman in a band. But one thing stood out about me that I read in one of your interviews is that and actually, you were talking about Antoine, but you were talking about kind of misogynistic lyrics. And how that's something that you actually, you know, growing up listening to the Dwarves and bands like that, you kind of were attracted to. Is there a little bit of like a, you know, like a, not conflict, but like a self-duality when it comes to that type of stuff?
I will say Dwarves are one of my favorite bands, like straight up, hands down, Blood, Guts, and Pussy. I could listen to that album over and over.
Right.
I love Brain Bombs, all that shit. And it's like a sexual thing. Like, I like that. It's like hot, you know?
Right.
And I was talking about this with this other writer that I know, and she was like, yeah, but she's like, it's because we're feminists, and it's just like against our grain. And so it's the appeal of that. And I was like, I don't know if it's more than that. I just like the aggression of it. And I don't know. I just think so much, especially with music, it's a performance.
Right.
What you're doing is like a very small fraction of what you actually are in as an entire person, you know? And as you grow as an artist. I notice it with myself. I'm being branded as feminist. Like, that, okay, you get, like, you be, there's a selling point, and I don't know, like, I don't know how I got on this, sorry. This is not about misogyny at all. But, yeah, I don't know, like, it's just, I like that stuff. Like, I like those bands. I don't really see a problem with it because I see it as performance. It's like, my friend Andrea always talks about this with Gigi Allen, where it's like, Gigi Allen used to, like, threaten rape, you know? Do you see the size of Gigi Allen's penis? He couldn't rape somebody if he fucking tried, okay? Do you know what I mean? Like, that stuff is performance, I think. And yeah, it can be damaging because there's a lot of people that don't understand that and then take that at face value and then recycle those ideas and are shitty. I don't know. I think it's just needs to be talked about. It's an expression.
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that, like, punk at its roots are kind of like the anti-establishment. So it's anything that you can kind of, like, knock the establishment off its guard. So in that sense, do you think, I know you guys are, you know, quote unquote a punk rock band. Would you say that punk has some sort of social responsibility, even if that's to be like anti responsible?
I think it has a responsibility to really, like, this is what I try and do, is like to deconstruct, to like break things up, to kind of be critical, and whether it's about something as simple as like, you know, sexism in this point in life, or something as stupid as, like, you know, I don't know, like some food coloring or damages of food coloring. I don't even know. But you know what I mean? Like, if you want to, like, whatever you want to talk about, it's just to break it down and to get people thinking and to do those kind of things. And to be, for me, like, when I'm writing lyrics, it's something that is more thoughtful and intellectual, and it's something that it's like a really good release for me, and I really try and put a lot of care into them. But then performing is totally raw and very just like, I don't think about it, you know, and that's all it is for me.
Like a cathartic experience.
Really, yeah. And like, I don't want there to be a responsibility, but I think any good music makes you think, you know, music's really powerful.
It's true. And if I'm going to be on this topic one more time as a self-proclaimed feminist, or as you've said in your writing, is chivalry, I've also had this conversation with Dana, our editor, is chivalry dead?
Okay. I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't think it is. See, okay, this is the problem. I spent this whole year hooking up with like my contemporaries, like, you know, indie rock, like hardcore guys, whatever, who are all a bunch of babies. And then it makes you think that chivalry maybe is dead. They're not men. You know, like, as much, and then you go...
Wait, hold on. Explain that. What makes them unmanly or not?
Oh, they're just such wussies. Like, it's just, there's no, like, you... I wrote an article about it for that... Do you know that magazine in New York called Self-Titled? I have a column with them called Better Than Food, where I write stories for. So I wrote one called Living Like Lord, which was about us being at Pitchfork, but it really wasn't about that. It was about me sleeping in this room with a lizard, and the lizard was a female who had eaten her male mate, and I was equating myself to the lizard because, you know, I'm too aggressive. Like, this is what it is. It's like, and you can't have it both ways, you know? Like, we want men to be a little more aggressive and all this stuff, but then complain about it. Like, it's hard. I'm glad I'm not a guy. That's all I gotta say. But I'm glad I'm not a dude. Maybe chivalry's not dead. I just think it needs to come from, like, it should be coming from both sides.
Right.
You know? There's nothing wrong with, like, doing something chivalrous for a man. And I'm speaking solely in, like, heterosexual stuff right now.
Right.
But, you know,
I tend to agree with you. I think it's one of those things that's kind of, you know, and I'm not speaking as someone who sees himself on one side or the other, but I think if you could find that person that's right in the middle, that's like the ideal.
And I don't even, like, chivalry is not so much important to me as manners. Like, do you know what I mean?
Right.
And
right.
respect.
Right.
Manners,
I mean,
and respect.
See, what I think you're talking about is manners, because chivalry, chivalry is the implication that women need and or deserve that sort of behavior, whereas manners extend to all humans.
Exactly. So maybe chivalry should be dead, you know, because, like, let's stop talking about chivalry and just focus on manners?
Maybe let's just start being nice to everyone. But I don't want to be nice to other dudes, you know?
What? Well, if you want to.
So
before, if they deserve it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have like 3 guy friends that I'm all right with. That's
okay.
So,
me too.
Before I let you go, our next guest is Andy Greenberg. He's a writer for Forbes, and he's the guy that interviewed Dread Pirate Roberts from the Silk Road. And so, we're pre-recording this. Your show in New York is on the 5th.
Oh, the 5th.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is technically going down on the 4th, but none of our listeners need to know that. But have you ever used Bitcoins or bought anything off of a black market website?
No, but I would have liked to. I was really bummed out when what was that Silk Road one?
Yeah. Dread Pirate Roberts.
But isn't that guy getting in tons of trouble?
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about next.
We're going to talk about that. That's exciting. Ooh,
he
okay.
is, he's I think, indicted on 6 counts of murder for hire.
Right. I read about that. Have you guys ever gone on the deep web?
I've attempted to, and then when I get to all these like firewalls that you need to like build third party somethings, I get really lazy.
I was talking about it with a friend of mine, and he was like, "Don't do it, man. It's too weird. Don't do it." Because I really want to, but I don't know. It seems it's like the black market of the internet or whatever.
Chivalry isn't dead on the dark web.
Oh, maybe it's not. Okay. Anyway, thanks, guys.
No, Mishwe, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you play tomorrow on December 5th with Ceremony and Perfect Pussy.
With Ross from Ceremony, guys. Okay, I'm going to tell you one thing. When we were playing in Florida a couple weeks ago, we were in a Taco Bell lineup at like 3 a.m. It was so packed. And Ross, like across the parking lot, I hear, Mishwe, it's Ross from Ceremony. And he's like wasted, hanging out the side of a van, screaming at me through the Taco Bell parking lot. So now whenever you talk about Ceremony, you have to say, oh, Ross from Ceremony?
The one who likes Taco Bell. I'm a huge fan. Taco Bell is like my favorite.
Ross from Ceremony? Yeah, I like it too.
That's my guilty pleasure. Well, Mish, thank you so much. And take care.
Have a nice day. Bye, guys.
Bye. Yeah, Canadians, man. We love Canadians here.
Canadians are the best.
Yes. Now, in hindsight, I don't know if that makes sense.
What?
I am horrible with words. We're going to play a couple white lung songs.
Jesus.
I know. I'm a little bit clemped from this 20-degree weather.
We're going to see if Dare's having a stroke, and we'll come right back.
Actually, this first song, I am going to play Eating Out first. I think that's a little more apropos.
Okay.
Since we were talking about that. We'll be right back.
Blueprint is the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. Designed to purify and detoxify, Blueprint Cleanse is made from the freshest 100% raw and USDA-certified organic ingredients, cold-pressed to retain nutrients and flavor. Blueprint also offers a line of organic juices, cold-pressed and raw, in a variety of fruit and vegetable combinations, and available in individual bottles. Blueprint Cleanse is available at Whole Foods Market and many other retailers across the U.S. To learn more about their line of organic cleanses, juices, and other products, visit them today at blueprint.com or call them at 866-774-6831. That's 866-774-6831. Work hard, play hard. Cleanse, repeat.
And we're back. And we're joined now by Andy Greenberg of Forbes and the author of This Machine Kills Secrets. I'm really having a hard time
author
today
of Susie Sells Seashells by the Seashore.
And also of, you know, you writing for Forbes, you're writing about the Silk Road.
That's right. And it's that story has become so crazy since the last time we talked about it.
So before we get into the intricate details of where it stands now, am I allowed to ask, are you behind him getting caught?
Well, some people within the Silk Road community did say that initially, but I think it's pretty clear that I'm not. I mean, he was so careful when he spoke to me. We're talking about the Dread Pirate Roberts, right?
Right,
like the guy who ran the Silk Road. And I had no idea who he was. I had never heard of this guy, Ross Ulbricht, who's now accused of being the Dread Pirate Roberts. The Dread Pirate Roberts who spoke to me only did so through Tor, this anonymity software. He was really careful about what he told me. You know, he basically told me to mind my own business whenever I asked him anything that could possibly be identifying. And at one point, he even, like, cut off contact with me for a month just because I asked him, like, where he lived, how old he was, whether he was male or female, stuff like that. So, I haven't been subpoenaed by the FBI. Nobody's talked to me about it. You know, I wish that I had identifying information because it would show that what a good reporter I am. But in fact, you know, I don't think that I could have helped the FBI identify him, which is probably a good thing because it would have gotten kind of hairy.
So the founder of the Silk Road, Ross Ulbricht?
Well, yeah, the alleged founder of the Silk Road, we can say. And he hasn't even been formally charged yet. He's like, they just denied him bail.
But that's not even about the Silk Road, though, correct? He's been arrested of murder for hire.
Well, actually, he has. This is the weird thing. He's definitely been the criminal complaint against him is all about the Silk Road.
Okay.
And it includes this story that he tried to have six people killed. One who was basically a potential witness against him, and then two more who he might have believed were going to blackmail him. They had hacked a Silk Road drug dealer and gotten a bunch of users' information, and they wanted money. And then three other people who were just kind of innocent bystanders. But the weird thing is that only one of those potential murder for hires is actually a criminal charge against him. The rest, they can't find the bodies. And very strangely, like the FBI says in the criminal complaint that they talked to Canadian law enforcement where they think this happened in British Columbia, mm-hmm. and found no evidence of actual murders. They just found the communications where the Dread Pirate Roberts tried to have these people killed, you know, asked to have them killed and paid all these bitcoins, like something, you know, like more than $700,000 in bitcoins to have all these people killed. But it seems like it's possible that murders never actually happened and they were all setups or scams. One of them was, we know now, was an FBI setup, and they actually staged a murder, took photographs of a guy, pretended that he had been killed, and sent them to the Dread Pirate Roberts to trick him into thinking that.
Yeah, I read that in one of your articles. Is that did they actually use the real guy?
Yeah, they did. This guy.
He was in on it then.
Yeah, he was in on it, and his name.
And he was co-founder, wasn't he?
Well, he was probably just an employee. I don't think he even knew who the Dread Pirate Roberts was. But yeah, he was, and this is even stranger. He was like a 47-year-old grandpa. Probably a Mormon, a guy who was, you know, selling heroin and became a Silk Road administrator and worked with the Dread Pirate Roberts and had some duties on the site, like trying to root out scammers and things. And it's not clear exactly where their relationship went wrong, but at some point it seems like the Dread Pirate Roberts or Ross Ulbricht or whoever he is started to see this guy as a potential threat and maybe a witness against him and tried to have him killed.
I think 47-year-old grandfather might be the most interesting thing said on this program.
I think it's kind of funny that that one was a scam, but all the other ones were potential scams too.
Well, the other ones...
Like, you can't even get someone reliably killed on the...
Right.
On the,
it seems like in one case, maybe he got scammed by the FBI, and in the five others, he might have gotten scammed by the Hell's Angels, who he thought he was hiring. I mean, this is like so Breaking Bad bizarre.
Yeah, that's like, actually what we said before we walked in. It definitely is Breaking Bad-esque.
Yeah, anyway, it seems like... As far as we can tell, nobody was killed. I mean, there are no bodies, except this one fake, you know, staged murder. So the five other ones, we don't know what happened. It seems like probably the Dread Pirate Roberts got scammed first by the FBI and then by the guys who he thought were his paid killers.
So does that make you nervous at all? Like, are you sweating at all about, you know, all these people that have wronged him? It's like coming out that he may be putting out hits for them.
Well, like I said, I'm not a good enough reporter for it to actually have wronged him. Like, I didn't have anything I could give up about him. If Ross Ulbricht is the Dread Pirate Roberts, then he's in prison in Brooklyn.
We tape in Brooklyn?
Oh my God! It's only 2 miles away.
Well, explain that to me. Why is it? Why is New York? I mean, Chris would probably know this as he's a diligent reporter. But why is he in New York?
It's this weird thing about the Southern District of New York that they seem to like lay claim to the whole internet as their jurisdiction, right? I mean, I find it confusing too. But it seems like all the big hackers get charged in New York.
It's also where all the best, quote unquote, best lawyers practice who work for the government. So they tend to funnel the cases through the Southern District because the experience is there, and because it's like the biggest stage, you know. So you have the best attorneys,
right? So all these big prosecutors,
right,
making their careers here,
correct?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly, the prosecutors in this case are, you know, making a big deal of it, and I think the careers will be made on both sides. The defense attorney in this case is really interesting too. Joshua Dreitel has defended some of the most high profile terrorism cases, like more than 30 of them in his career, including the sort of showcase incident that the NSA keeps bringing up as like the foiled terror plot that they found this guy who was like funneling money to Al-Qaeda. He defended that guy as well, and that guy was just sentenced to 18 years in prison. I don't know how well that bodes for
I mean, Ross 18 Ulbricht, years but, with the, you know, compared to the full force of the United States of America, I'd say that's a pretty good defense.
Yeah, maybe that's a good outcome. Yeah.
So when you were interviewing this guy, or when you were sort of, you had the liaison with him or whatever, did you get a sense that he would, I don't know, probably stoop isn't the right phrase, but stoop to something like this?
Like
would
the
he,
violence, the, yeah, the alleged yeah. violence. You know?
Right.
I was really surprised by a lot of elements of this. I mean, for one thing, I really thought the guy was older than this 29-year-old kid.
Why?
I just like the tone of his writing and just how formal he was and just how organized the whole thing was, the whole site. Maybe, you know, he just, I guess he used formality as a kind of mask in his writing. Like he didn't have any of the kind of turns of phrase like a young person would use, and probably because he knew that would be identifying. But yeah, the potential violence is a total shocker. And I have to say that, you know, I sympathized with the Dread Pirate Roberts that I spoke to. I mean, he was describing this free market, libertarian experiments. You know, I don't want to say that I'm some kind of radical libertarian, but I could tell that what he was doing was, this, it was supposed to be a kind of civil libertarian social experiment, I guess, is, you know, the way that he described it and the way I saw it, like this victimless, interesting experiment with legalizing drugs and seeing what happens. And violence wasn't supposed to be a part of it.
What do you think this says, like, on, and you know, because it was supposed to be not a legitimate experiment, but a genuine experiment. And what do you think this says about, you know, the heads of other corporations or, like, in the future, you know, if something like this were to exist on the internet, I guess what I'm asking is how many heads of corporations are crooks and this evil based on, you know, I'm thinking of the Waltons. Obviously, the Waltons haven't had anyone killed, but they're, you know, masters of this giant corporate domain.
Yeah, I think it's it's this great, like, almost Shakespearean thing about the corruption of power, you know, like,
right.
I think, and it's not just a corporate thing, it's probably a government thing. And in fact, it's, I think that it also shows the limits of a kind of lawless space. I think that Ross Ulbricht, if he is the Dread Pirate Roberts, was thinking that you know, as a with his libertarian viewpoint, that he could carve out this space where the government couldn't get in, and then he could create his own ethics. But in fact, when you take away all the rules, you have to make your own rules and you have to enforce them with your own violence. And that's what he wasn't counting on. And I think these ideals got corrupted. It's really a sad story.
I keep coming back. You were talking about that he didn't use like phrases like a young person was. And I'm thinking like he's like, you know, asking you to join him on the Davenport. And now you're on the trolley. Saying like really old man phrases to throw you off. Now, you also, about a week, well, earlier this week, you wrote about another black market website that is crowdfunding murder for hires.
Right. Well,
this is completely unrelated, right?
Right. Except that I think this guy was certainly inspired by right. the Silk Road, and they come from sort of the same place of this ultra libertarian crypto anarchy on the internet, you know, enabled by the anonymity software Tor and the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. So this was a website that was totally anonymous. You know, it runs on Tor. Anybody who visits it is anonymous, and the guy running it is anonymous as well. He calls himself Kuwabatake Sanjuro. That's definitely his pseudonym, and it's a reference, I guess. You know, he said that it was inspired in some ways by the Dread Pirate Roberts and the creator of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto. And the idea of this site is that anybody can contribute Bitcoins that are pooled together into like a crowdfunded political assassination. It's like a Kickstarter for murder of politicians.
It's like the American Idol voting, but someone dies.
But still someone has to be the like point person. Someone has to be the Simon that's like pulls the trigger, basically.
And as far as we know, that hasn't happened yet. But the yeah, there's like right now there are, I'm not sure what the exchange rate is for Bitcoin, but I think there's probably more than $80,000 anyway riding on Ben Bernanke's head. That if somebody killed Ben Bernanke, and I'm not like saying that anybody should do that. they could,
on record as saying he does not feel that way.
They can basically collect $80,000 worth of bitcoins from this website, unless it's a scam. But there are a lot more. There are a lot of ways to do a scam.
Why do they hate the Fed so much?
Well, you know, the Fed is the number one enemy of every Bitcoin libertarian, right?
Okay, but aren't there people more powerful than Ben Bernanke? Probably, you know. I don't know. He seems like granted, he's a big fish, but he's not the biggest fish.
Yeah, I mean, I am not really like...
That seems like such a symbolic target.
I've never been interested in Bitcoin for like these really like hard economic reasons, and I don't know why anybody hates the Fed as much as these guys do. But the idea is that if you it's not about just taking out like one or two politicians. This is about scaring the entire government to the degree that nobody wants to hold office at all. I mean, Kuwabatake Sanjuro wants to destroy all government, not just a few corrupt officials. He believes that he can prevent people from holding office and usher in this new age of anarchy. This is like a really old idea attached to the whole assassinations market thing. This was invented in the 90s, actually, by this guy named Jim Bell, who wrote an essay called Assassination Politics. This is all in my book, because I think it helped to inspire WikiLeaks, although I shouldn't say that. They're really different. But Jim Bell dreamt about using these anonymous, untraceable payment methods to crowdfund assassinations back in like 1997. So, and the idea was to destroy the government, to wipe out the world's militaries, and you know, create this anarchist libertarian utopia.
What is the government doing about this site, if anything?
You know, I don't know. I called the Secret Service and the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and none of them wanted to comment. But it's when I called the Secret Service, who I think would be running point on this probably, because Barack Obama is listed as well, and there's you know something like $25,000 on his head on this site or something. They said no comment so quickly. I hadn't even finished describing the website, so it was almost. I have to believe that they're aware of this. That you know it's on their radar. They're doing some investigative work already.
Were you contacted at all when Ross, am I saying it right? Ulbricht. Were you contacted at all by any government agencies when
not before he was arrested, but after he was arrested, and this is really unusual. I mean, I've written about people before who then get arrested. But in this case, I think the FBI was so eager to, like, rub it in the faces of the Silk Road community that they called me and they emailed me and then they called me and wanted to specifically respond to the interview that I did with him.
Right,
and
right.
Say, he told you that he would never be caught and he would be anonymous, but nobody is anonymous to the FBI. We will track you down. You know, there was this, they wanted to send a message.
Yeah. Did you write that story?
Oh, yeah. I've quoted them on that for sure.
So now after Ross was caught, quote unquote, we're going to say, I'm going to use your terminology and say that if he is the Dread Pirate Roberts, when he was caught, the price of Bitcoins, like, went through the roof. Isn't that true?
Well, it dropped for one day, and everybody took the opportunity to say, oh, look, Bitcoins are only used for the Silk Road, and as soon as the Silk Road goes away, Bitcoins lose all their value. But then they were, you know, immediately proven wrong, and Bitcoins, like, the price just skyrocketed, and it hasn't stopped.
I heard they got as high, or they're upwards of, like, $800.
They were as high as 900, and it's still, I think everybody's trying to figure out why. Like, with any economic thing, any market, it's hard to figure out what the real cause is. But it seems like the Silk Road might be part of it, in the sense that when people saw that the Silk Road went away and Bitcoin didn't lose all of its value, maybe, Bitcoin is, like, it's legitimized in a way. But also,
and also by the government, too, by cracking down as hard as they did, right? I mean, if the government's that frightened of Bitcoins, then doesn't that increase their value, too?
It could be. I mean, maybe there's a kind of, like, Streisand effect,
yeah.
You know, you try to stop something, but actually the unintended consequence is that it gets bigger than, just because you're paying so much attention to it. But there's also this story that the Chinese are buying into Bitcoin really heavily right now. And, then there were these congressional hearings where regulators basically said, Bitcoin is okay. We're not going to try to take this down.
They just got priced out of my, they just went out of my price range, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote about Bitcoin for the first time in 2011 when it was worth a dollar. And now it's like, if I had just put in a couple $1,000s, I could retire.
Do you regret not investing in Bitcoins, and would investing in them, would that be considered a conflict of interest? Like, would you be able to write about them for
Forbes? I tell myself that it would have been a conflict of interest because otherwise I just want to cry.
But the last time you were here, after got home and I thought about it a little bit, I tried to figure out how to purchase Bitcoins, and it was too difficult for my feeble mind to figure out.
Well, you just have to use Coinbase, really. There are, like, more anonymous ways to buy Bitcoins, but the easy way is just to use this service where you sign up with your email address, and then if you really want to, do illegal things with your Bitcoins, you can launder them after that. Yeah, but Coinbase is really the easiest. I don't want to plug any company, that I've used. Yeah.
As I said before, we've broken down the fourth wall. This is airing on the fourth. But I want to talk to you about Bitcoin Black Friday. Have you heard at all about this?
No.
I just caught him. Way to do your research. No. There's a they're having a Black Friday. That's all, Bitcoin company based.
Oh, so who is participating in Bitcoin?
That's what you were supposed to be answering.
Oh, man. Well, I'm not interested in using Bitcoins for, like, fun and legal things and, like, buying televisions and stuff and sushi and socks. I mean, can you buy heroin on Bitcoin Black Friday? Because otherwise, I'm not really interested.
I'm sure you could buy just about anything. I'm going to... Well, I mean, the thing is this is, making... it's kind of like there... It is another... what's the word I'm looking for?
What about murders? Can you buy murders on Bitcoin?
Wedgies. What if you could buy wedgies?
Like a wedgie hitman.
Yeah, like a wedgie hitman. To me, that's like the... That's
I think maybe you should create a wedgie market... A Tor-enabled Bitcoin-funded wedgie market.
It would be like the film Dirty Work with Norm MacDonald and Artie Lang. Remember that film?
I never saw that.
No, but it's like they're like revenge for hire.
Yeah, like wedgie contracts.
And that's like gray enough to where the government probably wouldn't mess with you, but you're still doing something that's not entirely legal.
Yeah,
and fun.
How much do you think it would cost in Bitcoins to, like, get somebody to wedgie Bill Gates
or Ben Bernanke?
Yeah, Ben Bernanke. I mean.
That would, and isn't a wedgie more gratifying than an assassination? I mean, assassinations are so messy and someone dies, but a wedgie's forever, him being wedgied on national television.
The thing with assassinations, it's like short term gratification, because then in the long term you got to think about how much extra security is going to be beefed up, and
they just elect someone else, or they just put someone else in the position.
Yeah, and they'll put them in front of a glass, and everyone else gets the actually, back to your question, it said last year there were 75 merchants, and it doesn't mean, and this year they expect more, but that doesn't mention anything of illegal in the story.
So we got like Pier 1 imports.
Says everything from organic coffee and unlocked smartphones to underwear and solar panels. Although unlocked smartphones, I guess, could be deemed as something.
Yeah. My nipples are not hard from unlocked smartphones.
I mean, right now, if you had a bunch of bitcoins, would you really spend them on whatever, like an unlocked smartphone? Or would you want to hold on to them because they're appreciating so quickly?
I'll tell you what. It depends.
That's actually a really good point. That's what needs to be done, is interview all the people who participate in this and be like, what the hell is wrong with you? Why are you spending these things?
For instance, when we did the story in Forbes about Silk Road, we bought, 3 grams of marijuana from 3 different websites.
Yeah.
And I think we spent spent $75 worth of bitcoins. And today that's let me see. Bitcoin at that point was about $100.
Right.
And now it's $800. So, we spent, that was the most expensive weed anybody's
right.
ever
so
bought.
So averaging out at about $500, that means it's about $4,000?
I don't know. I've already lost track.
Did Forbes spend all of the bitcoins? Were you forced to liquidate all the bitcoins?
Well, I actually do have a third of a bitcoin left over. Financial disclosure. I forgot. Yeah. And I don't know what to do with it, really. I feel like I should be saying, at some point, Bitcoin might be valuable enough that I have to say in every story about it, I own one third of a bitcoin. And, but it feels so silly to say that.
One third of a Bitcoin now is what, $300?
Yeah, well, $250 or something.
Yeah, give or take.
Hey.
Well, it's interesting, though, because there's probably the other side of the equation where you're thinking to yourself, okay, I bought this Bitcoin for $1, or let's just say you even bought it for $20, and now it's worth that much. But, that same person could be thinking, oh, it could fluctuate at any time. I can get a smartphone for one Bitcoin.
No, I still wouldn't. No.
I don't know. This is the difficult thing about Bitcoin as an actual useful currency. For it to appreciate and not crash at some point, people have to accept it. People have to spend it and receive it for goods. But people don't want to do that when it's appreciating this fast. So, I think the Silk Road was actually a really great use for Bitcoin, because people needed their drugs. They didn't care if it was going to appreciate the next day. They needed their heroin. In fact, when Bitcoin was really booming and crashing a lot, I read comments like this on the Silk Road forums. Both people theorizing about it and people actually saying, I need my heroin now and I'm not going to wait, even though I know that I could get more tomorrow.
But see, even and that trumps the fact that they could cash in those bitcoins and buy way more heroin, just on the street, right?
I guess that might be true.
Because
a lot more difficult, though.
As the price of weed is inflated on that market, so is the price of all the other drugs, unless it's super hard to find or something.
Yeah, I don't really. I mean,
unless you're snorting moon dust or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm too square to know where you can actually buy good heroin. But the thing about the Silk Road was that there were vendor ratings and reviews,
right,
and probably higher quality stuff than in every category.
You see another Silk Road popping up soon?
Oh, there already are.
What's the story with the new Silk Road?
There is already a Silk Road 2.0 with a Dread Pirate Roberts 2.0. And it seems to be pretty much exactly the same thing. A lot of people were hoping in the community that it was going to be some kind of new improved Silk Road. It's basically just the same thing recreated, and nonetheless, it's there. There are thousands of drugs listed already. But there are also sites that existed, long before any of
right.
these new ones. Black Market Reloaded is probably the second oldest site, after the Silk Road, and it seems to be going along fine. They sell guns and explosives and things and forged documents as well as all the drugs.
I'm trying to think of some documents I need forged. Before, that's immediately where my mind went. I was like,
"You should think about it off air."
What can I have forged? Before we let you go, Andy, I feel like as the story progresses, because it feels like there's going to be a lot of twists and turns. I don't think it's a topic that's going to, at least the bitcoins, maybe certain websites might come and go as they do. But I think this is going to be a discussion topic for a few years to come.
Yeah, I think the Bitcoin is, you know, Bitcoin is really the big story, and I think it's here to stay. And, you know, each one of these is just like one little event in this big movement, I think, of people adopting this cryptocurrency, and, you know, it's going to enable all kinds of strange anarchic experiments.
Do you find yourself spending the majority of your time on Bitcoins? Do you fear being pegged as like the Bitcoin guy?
Well,
as a reporter?
I don't know. I kind of, it seems like it's always good to have like one, like thing that people are, you know, go to you to look for. And for some reason, this guy, Kawabatake Sanjuro, with the assassination market, sought me out, which is kind of a scary thing. But, you know, that's like the way you get stories, as you know, as a reporter.
Yeah, and then the government came to you, too, after the Silk Road.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. I hope that, yeah, I mean, in a way, it is kind of creepy to be the guy that the assassinations market and the FBI both seek out to tell their stories. But, yeah, it's good for business.
So the last thing I think we should end on, as we got to get going quick soon, but where do things stand? Like, what do you expect to happen with this the lawsuit? And Ross, is he gonna take the fall for Silk Road and then build Bitcoin?
I mean,
and
is
everyone
this gonna
else?
Drag yeah. out for years, or are they gonna settle, or like how you know?
I try to keep an open mind, and I spend a lot of time talking to his defense attorney, and I think that I when I'm with him, I fall into his reality distortion field to some degree, and I think, wow, this is actually pretty circumstantial evidence. But then in the bail hearing the other day, I have to say, I mean, if I were Ross or his family, I would have a big lump in my throat right now. I mean, like, the evidence that the government has assembled is, you know, pretty convincing. They did, you know, they arrested him just after he'd entered his password in a library on his computer, and they took screenshots. They seized what they say is his journal describing his entire history of creating the Silk Road, and this logbook where he allegedly wrote stuff like, "Today I paid the Hell's Angels for killing these guys," you know, stuff that is going to be really, I'm glad that I'm not his defense attorney.
Wow.
You know, it's weird that you say that, because that sounds pretty damning, but then the cynic in me makes me think that, like, they're throwing on these extra charges almost in a way to kind of be like, here's what evil can be wrought by these websites, and we're going to take you down for each and every one of them to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, it's interesting to see that there was a big movement to you know, provide like legal defense funds for Ross Ulbricht, and you would think that the Silk Road community would get behind him, mm-hmm. But I think that this like specter of violence has really scared people, and they don't want to be associated with someone they think might be a murderer. And so in that way, the government has done a really good job of sort of like tainting this guy and making him seem unappealing and dangerous, when in fact this could have been more of a story about like, was legalizing drugs an interesting mm-hmm. move? Was it something admirable? You know?
Well, at least the Bitcoin and the topic of internet currency is now on the forefront of at least the technological minds of America or the world, versus, you know, something that I never knew about until you came on the show. So,
yeah. Well, me too. I mean, I like you said, if Bitcoin were really all just about Black Friday, I wouldn't be that interested in it either. But, you know, the Silk Road has made Bitcoin sexy in a way, and I think that it launched just after Bitcoin became a thing, and I think it was really instrumental in making Bitcoin a popular, useful tool.
Cool. Invest in Bitcoins, invest in Andy's book, This Machine Kills Secrets.
Yeah, Andy, thank you.
That's a plug.
Thank you.
That was good.
Thank you. Thank you again for joining us. Like I said, this is a story that I think will continue to unravel, and it's always interesting having you here.
Well, thank you guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, of course. And that's
next
it.
Time.
And yeah, everyone, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.